Thompson, Mr. Ruff.
May it please the court, Nathaniel Ruff for plaintiff, appellant Juanita Jordan. When I reviewed my brief in preparation for the argument, I realized that I may not have as clearly as I should have set out the hierarchy, just to fit in the players and the actions that occurred. Though I think it's fairly clear if you look at all of the documents that Donald Thompson was director of human resources, of health and human services. His appointee, Ida Parker, was head of the health clinic, and then under her was a sexually transmitted disease clinic where these events occurred. So that when Donald Thompson reached down to impose discipline on Juanita Jordan, he was going through several levels. He was going through Parker, superseding Parker, superseding the head of the STD clinic, Alicia James, to reach her. The essence of our argument, and I realize there's an issue regarding constructive discharge, but the essence of our position is that we did raise a sufficient factual basis under the McDonnell-Douglas burden shifting to establish, first of all, a prima facie case that she was meeting the reasonable expectations of her employer. There's no doubt that she met the age and sex requirements of the class. We also believe we've raised a sufficient triable issue on the issue of pretext with respect to three incidents of discipline that were imposed on her by Mr. Thompson. One, suspension for not wearing a hat. And we introduced evidence there was absolutely no policy or procedures of the clinic for wearing a hat.
Well, how about her excessive tardiness?
The excessive tardiness.
Now about her, how about giving confidential information from the firm?
The excessive tardiness was not an issue that had been raised for discipline or for the basis for firing her under the by Mr. Thompson. With respect to the release of confidential information, that was the third of a list of alleged violations. And that occurred while she was on suspension for supposedly not informing her supervisor that she was going to file a grievance when she claims that she did inform her supervisor. But in any event, very suspicious circumstances with respect to that, in that the call was made to the clinic, was not reported for 16 days by the person who allegedly received the call, another person named Roberts. There is no identifying information given on as to the client, to the file number. And she was gone at the time. So there's absolutely no way that she can trace back to see if there was any legitimacy to this call. And there's, in fact, nothing to support it other than some allegation of some unnamed person calling somebody at the health department who took the call and reported it 16 days later. No name, file information. So that we would submit is certainly a triable issue with respect to whether she did release information. In fact, there seems absolutely, if there's an issue, it's the other way, that they had not established a triable issue to show that she released it, but certainly the jury issue. The middle one of the three core disciplines that occurred all within a short period of time, I think all in May and June of 2000, was that my client allegedly did not report that she was going to file a grievance. She did not report this to her supervisor. She states in her affidavit she did report it to Alicia James, who she believed to be her supervisor. Supposedly, there had been a switch in supervisors made to this Roland Carey in the interim, but it had never been reported to anyone. And all of the documents show that he was made the supervisor, but after those events. So it's simply our position that these are tribal issues and that the court should not have...
What is the racial composition of the office?
The racial composition, I believe, is heavily African-American.
How likely is it that her race played any role?
Her race did not play a role.
This is just...
Age and sex discrimination.
Well, I'm sorry, I'm confused. Well, what... and sex, what is the... Weren't there a lot of women in the...
Well, yes. There were a lot of women.
And a lot of them were older.
The older, and our evidence was that he had a tendency, in fact, a decided effort to make life extremely miserable for older women.
But for women as such?
Appears to be older women.
Older.
I mean, he may not have been the nicest supervisor for all women, but the heart of the attack seemed to be on the older women, as shown not only by the three incidents of discipline to Juanita, but also the other actions that he took with respect to her. He yelled at her, he blamed her for some alleged attempt to go to an attorney regarding his wanting to restructure. He blamed her for allegedly, yelled at her for allegedly going to the newspapers when she didn't. He changed her position from, although she had been one of the most successful, highly respected disease intervention experts in the state of Indiana, and the state representative said as such, he moved her to a phlebotomist job. And then Mrs. Parker was talking to other individuals saying, you know, we should really get away. You should be careful who you deal with. Don't deal with this individual. Don't deal with Juanita. So it's not just the three incidents. It's the whole surrounding circumstances, which leads us to the issue of the constructive discharge. Our position is that this created not only a normally hostile environment for older women that would give rise to a claim of discrimination, but an excessive, it went to that extra step.
Well, did any other of these older women join in this suit, or did they testify for it?
We have evidence of two of the other women. Mrs. Steele.
You said a number of them. I thought there were...
I'm sorry, I apologize. There were only two. There were three older women. There was a Perlina Hammond, there was a Mrs. Steele, and there was Jody, and there was Juanita Jordan.
They've also been discharged?
They have not been discharged, but the evidence we presented was that they were, especially Mrs. Steele, was continually harassed, had been charged with false charges, had been her laboratory had been taken away from her that she had established. She was made to run up and down the stairs to do the lab work, causing actually her veins to break.
You're in your rebuttal time, Neil.
The circumstances were such that when Mr. Donald Thompson called her back and told her, you know, if you do one thing, he yelled at her, if you do one thing more wrong, you're going to be fired. You're demoted. Your pay is cut. You're on probation after 16 years. And yelled at her all of that. And under all of those circumstances, our position, she could reasonably believe that she was being set up to be fired, and that it consistent with the minimum sense of her own dignity, she should be allowed. She had to quit, and the case is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission versus University of Chicago Hospital. And if you trace down...
Your time is almost up completely.
I'll reserve then whatever short period I have. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ruff. Ms. Morris?
May it please the court, my name is Sonia Morris, and I am counsel for the City of Gary and Donald Thompson. Appellee Thompson's motion for summary judgment was granted on September 9th of 2003. The question on appeal is whether the court erred in granting summary judgment on appellant's claim of both sex and age discrimination in violation of Title VII and the ADEA. Employment discrimination cases are often divided between direct evidence cases in which there's evidence that the employer has virtually confessed to unlawful discrimination, and indirect proof cases which follow the McDonnell-Douglas versus Green burden-shifting method. The indirect burden-shifting method under McDonnell-Douglas, Jordan must establish a prima facie case of discrimination. If Jordan establishes a prima facie case, the burden shifts to Thompson in order to prove a legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for Jordan's termination. Jordan, who still has the burden to prove discrimination, must then present evidence of pretext that the proffered reason was not genuine. The second issue is whether Jordan proved through a mosaic of evidence that Thompson treated older women or older employees differently. Lastly, whether Jordan was constructively discharged from her employment with the City of Gary's Health Department. It is our position that Jordan failed on the second and third prong of the burden-shifting test as outlined by McDonnell Douglas. Initially, it's conceded that Jordan was in a protected class based on her sex, female, and her age, 60 years. That she was meeting the employer's expectation is not conceded, and that assertion must fail. We have a litany with regard to Ms. Jordan's performance in the department. It begins in January of 1993, where she was reprimanded for refusal to attend mandatory meetings. In August of 1993...
Well, see, my impression is she's actually an excellent employee, but she's insubordinate. Isn't that the problem?
That would be...
I mean, she is apparently highly regarded as a, you know, sexually transmitted disease expert.
In her opinion, she is highly regarded. In the opinion of the managers from the state in Indianapolis, were not familiar with her record as an employee, her tardiness, her insubordination,
This is kind of having to do with reality. Were the hats that she was wearing particularly obnoxious, or are they just regular old hats?
What's important about the head wrap was that on a Friday, she was instructed not to return.
I understand that, but I want to know what provoked the particular irritation about the hats.
I
have many aldermen in Chicago who wears hats regularly and all sorts of things, and some of them are kind of wacky looking. I wondered whether or not this...
And it was sort of a turban, something you wear, as she stated during the deposition, that you would wear when your hair is uncombed.
Who cares? People don't dress carefully anymore.
I think what's important is that she was insubordinate. Stating to an employee, please do not return with a hat, and you return, and that's her practice. She called out from work, but checked in to remove one of the vehicles.
The fanciest law firms in Chicago don't have dress codes anymore. They're not fancy anymore.
They're not fancy anymore either.
The City of Gary has a dress code, and they were enforcing that code and advised the employees on a Friday. And on the Monday, Ms. Jordan returned.
Your position is that it's a legitimate request not to wear a hat, and she wouldn't do it. She kicked up her heels.
The important thing about the older employees in the health department is that it was their department. After 14 years, we run the show. And unfortunately, Mr. Thompson came in without a health degree or a science degree, and the employees were not particularly happy with his method of administration. And therefore, the older employees wanted things to remain the same.
The employees, they could wear hats if they wanted to, is that it?
Actually, I am not sure. They believe that some wore hats, and they were men, and I think it was because of a religious observance. But the types of hats that we're speaking of with Ms. Jordan, it's borderline on the offensive. It's something you would wear outside.
People were allowed to wear hats for religious there was a religious exemption from the no-hat rule?
And there was no exemption at the time the new rule was in place, but there was a reference to a gentleman who wore a hat to work, and we're simply saying that that was a part of a religious...
It had nothing to do with his hairstyle or anything. It had to do with the religious impulse to wear, a requirement to wear a hat.
That's correct.
I've learned something new about religion.
But with regard to the constructive discharge, it's our position that Ms. Jordan does not meet the standard as found in the Tutman case, where the employee, it's stated that the employee refused to return to work after someone stated that they would quote-unquote pop a cap, which was an inference that he would be shot. He left the employment and never returned, and this court stated that that was, did not meet the greater standard for a hostile work environment. It referred to a number of other cases where the employee, a gun was actually held to the employee's head, and also where pornographic pictures were shown to an employee and she was grabbed and sort of roughed up. Therefore, it's our impression that the appellant failed on their prima facie case of discrimination under Title VII and ADA, and that the district court was correct in awarding summary judgment to the appellee.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Morris.
Thank you.
Mr. Ruff, how much time does he have? 1 minute?
Judge Ponser, I would just slightly like to disagree with your characterization of my client, that she stands up for herself, but there is really no evidence that we believe is in the record that she was insubordinate. Now, she did not follow an order to take off the hat. That is insubordination, yes. But there were no rules, regulations, or never had been a rule or regulation about the wearing of the hat. She had worn a hat.
And then if one of her superiors came in and told her to take it off, and she didn't do it.
Right. I mean, what's the difference between an order and a rule?
Well, because if there is a rule that people, if there's a dress code and she's not following it, if there's a problem with their particular hat, if there's a problem with their particular behavior, then there's a reason for following.
But I think you have it backwards, because rules have to be interpreted. But if you get a direct order, no hat, that's unequivocal. And unless it's an illegal order, which is not argued, then if you don't obey it, you are insubordinate. And even if she's an excellent disease intervention specialist, a worker who disobeys orders is undermining the discipline of the workplace, so it's a standard ground for firing someone.
Yes, our position is, though, that the evidence shows that there was no dress code.
Look, forget it. You're barking up the wrong tree. She's told, she's given an unequivocal, lawful order. It may be a stupid order, but it's lawful. She disobeys it, and so her supervisor is concerned because it undermines discipline to have workers who disobey orders, even if they're dumb orders.
Right.
So people get fired for that.
I guess our position would be that it was not lawful in the sense that...
No, it was lawful. You didn't say it's an illegal order. They can have stupid rules about dress codes if they want. That doesn't violate any law.
If they were uniformly applied, but to ask one person to take off their hat when others wear them.
Well, there are other people wearing hats. Other people wear hats regularly.
Yes, and continue to wear hats.
Well, so did these people have a religious ground?
No, there's no evidence that it was...
But the affidavit, there are other people who wore hats?
In her affidavit, she said other people wore hats and continued to wear hats, and it wasn't a religious... There's no evidence that it was...
Were they told, were they ordered not to wear hats?
Apparently not. I don't know. So the point is that...
The record shows this, huh?
Yes. Her affidavit, I don't have it right, but her affidavit says otherwise.
Okay, we have the record. We can see it.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much to both counsel.